Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming back. We're going to finish what we started last week. We talked about the timing of the book of Joshua, when it would have occurred, starting in 1406, going up to like 1399 BC. Had some information about the Egyptian inscription. We're going to talk tonight about just the author was probably Joshua, and we're going to look at page one of that last week's notes. But I do want to point out, I also have a part two of the notes, and that's got a few maps on it. But at the end, right before I came, I decided I'd go ahead and put a third set of notes, which would just, they're just maps, which is, again, a main part of Joshua, because the whole book of Joshua is about God fulfilling his promise. God promised Abraham in Genesis chapter 12 he's going to make him into a great nation. He's going to give him a land. He made a covenant with him in chapter 15 and told him the dimensions of the land in chapter 15 of Genesis. So we're talking 2000 BC. And then we went through the four generations of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, then Joseph, and then four generations in Egypt, and Moses coming out in 1446 with the intention of God saying, I'm going to take you to the land I promised to Abraham. And so on that third set of notes, we'll take a look at that in a little bit, is on the first page you've got the dimensions of the land that God gave to Abraham in Genesis 15. We'll read that. And then the next page, you're going to have Moses describing the land in Numbers 34, verses 1 through 12, and there's another map of that. The following page is, which would be page 3, I believe, is at the beginning of the book of Joshua, Joshua restating those borders and giving you different land forms, and you know, if it's mountains, if it's borders, if it's cities. And then in chapter 13, when the land is taken, which is interesting because there's that same border that we saw in chapter 1, but you can see the inside of that, more of the size of Israel today. That's the land that generally the land that was taken. And in Joshua 13, the Lord tells him, this is the land that has not been taken. And they're supposed to divide the tribes up, and the tribes then are supposed to finish taking the land. Joshua wasn't supposed to conquer the entire land. He got them into the land, divided the land, and says, okay, you're on your own now. Again, working in God's plan in their territory, they're to take the rest of that land. And again, notice it extends up to the Euphrates River. The last map is just, again, a closer up view with some of the names given on there. And you can see there's quite a bit of land that needs to be taken. The land was eventually reached the Euphrates during David's reign. And then it quickly shrunk after Solomon. It was divided. And then it wasn't until Jeroboam II in northern Israel, Jonah prophesied that there'd be a time of prosperity, the border expanded again up to the Euphrates for a few years. We're talking, you know, during the reign of Jeroboam II, so maybe 10, 15 years. And then, of course, then they quickly collapsed, and within 6 months after Jeroboam II's death, Israel his line was executed, Zechariah, his son. And then that was so 737 or something. And then by 722, Israel's gone. And so that promise is still hanging there. And so what this book is about, it's about taking the land. It's about God fulfilling his promise. So the land is very important. We cannot forget. We can talk, again, we want to make spiritual applications and Christian principles. But this book is about the land being taken by Joshua, the land promised to Abraham for his people that was going to become a great nation. This land has nothing to do with the Mosaic Covenant. The Mosaic Covenant was going to be part of the rule, the organization of the people when they got to the land. But the Mosaic Covenant was going to come, and the Mosaic Covenant was going to go as it has. But the Abrahamic Covenant that began in chapter 12, chapter 15, is still a covenant that continues. Now, should Israel be in the land today? Now, that's a political issue. You're talking about God's timing. You're talking about the politics. A lot of things. And so when the time is right, God will put Israel back in this land and fulfill the Abrahamic covenant, I believe. I don't think it's been fulfilled totally. I don't think it's been a covenant that's going to come and go. It's an everlasting covenant, just like Abrahamic covenant, the Davidic covenant, which promises there's going to be a king from the line of David ruling over Abraham's people forever in the land. So you've got to have the nation of Israel, you've got to have the land, and you've got to have the line of David ruling over a nation that's going to endure forever. And that king, we know, is Jesus. And, of course, that's a lot of information to make a play on this. So anyway, we will take a look at this. I want to go back to the first set of notes and that we looked at last week. And, we talked about the timing of it. Again, there's reasonable understanding that Joshua entered the land in 1406. It took about 5 years to conquer the land. So now it's 1401. By the time they divided the land up and the book of the Joshua ends, there's been a couple years. So you're in 1399 B.C. So these events are taking place right between 1406 and 1399 B.C. I think, and again, people can decide this and talk about it. Commentators are all over the board on it. But it seems that the book was written by an eyewitness. So we look on page one of the notes. Point number one, Jewish tradition holds the belief that the bulk of the book was written by Joshua himself. There is clearly a couple minor details at the end that Eleazar has to record that Joshua died because Joshua couldn't write about his own death. And then someone has to write about Eleazar dying, which is probably the high priest. And so probably the son that succeeded him, which would be Phinehas, wrote about that. There may be a couple places within the book where the places are updated as the book was handed down and copied and transmitted. They may have updated the name places. They may have added some more details, just to kind of clarify it for the readers at that time. But I think the bulk of the book was written by Joshua. If not by Joshua, at least by someone that was with Joshua when these events took place. I do not think this book was written by memory. I do not think this was an oral tradition handed down for generations. And sometime in Babylon, they tried to get everything written down and they finally got a chance. I don't think that's the case because we know these people, Moses was writing, Joshua was helping Moses record things, and so there's no reason to believe that Joshua didn't write these things down, especially since it's such an important event, the fulfillment. It's not an abstract, just random thing that happened to Israel. It's what they are all about. They are all about the land. Beginning at this point in history, it was the time. It was the fourth generation. It had been 400 years. And that stuff is written down, and they have that. They have the book of Genesis with them. And so they know these covenants. They're living for these covenants. So the coming into this land is a big deal. It's what they are all about. They're existing for this very reason. And to think they just skipped into the land and then go, well, let's start planting some crops and then make a big deal about it. They're pivoting around this issue. So it's not hard to imagine them making a record of the conquering of the land. The Talmud, the Jewish commentary of the law and tradition says, quote, Joshua wrote his own book. Support for Joshua's authorship. A, the author was an eyewitness of the events that happened in the book, as in chapter 5, verses 1 through 6, when it says, we talked about this last week, where it says, we went into the land, and that pronoun could be we, which is in the Hebrew. Sometimes it ends up getting translated as they. The author was Jewish, according to chapter 5, verse 6. He was one of the sons of Israel, and they believed in the promised land. They know why they're there. They're coming in to fulfill the promise. Point C, the book of Joshua claims Joshua is the author of certain parts of the book, as in Joshua 8:20. And I do want to look at these things, if you don't mind. Take the book of Joshua, go to Joshua. So Joshua burned Ai and made it a permanent heap of ruins, a desolate place to this day. Now, one of the phrases that's going to be important is going to be this right here, to this day, because that phrase, to this day, is going to come up several times, to this day. Now, whenever this is being written, there's several things here that can still be seen or remembered or visited to this day, whatever day this is. So if Joshua was writing it, it's going to be, say, 1399 or the days after that, some years after that, that he's going to write these things down, you can still go see it. It happened at this time in 1406. You can still see the remains to this day. And we've got a whole list of events taking place there. And they raised a large pile of rocks over it, which remains to this day. Then Joshua built on Mount Ebal. And then this is where they're going to go to Mount Ebal. And they're going to make a covenant. And Joshua is going to read verse 34 afterwards. Joshua read all the words of the law, the blessings and the curses, just as it is written in the book. There was not a word of that Moses had commanded that Joshua did not read to the whole assembly, including the women and the children and the aliens who lived among them. A lot of things happening here. Notice there's aliens living among them. So when they start driving out the Canaanites, there is going to be Rahab is going to convert and join them. Her family is going to convert and join them. And so there's going to be aliens. And so these aliens could be some that have come up out of Egypt with them. But those were the multitudes or some of the masses that had left with Israel. Some of them had left with Israel. Some of the Egyptians actually left with them. In this case, the Canaanites are going to be joining. The Gibeonites are going to be joining the Israelites. They're afraid of them. So they're going to have a little bit of deception. Some of the other ones that you're going to see here, looking back at the notes. I was going to read chapter 24, verse 26 also, and then we're going to go through the list. Chapter 24, verse 26. And notice Joshua is reading. Now, we understand Joshua was born as a slave. So he was at some point a slave in Israel. He came out with Moses, and one of the first things that happens is there's going to be an attack on the backside of Moses' caravan, the Exodus, by the Amalekites. Moses appoints Joshua to go off and fight the Amalekites. Joshua must be 35 years old, or so we can go through these numbers here in a little bit. But I want you to notice that going from a slave to then being commanded to take and form an army, that they don't have an army. He forms a military, arm themselves, and then fight the Amalekites, and there is a victory. Of course, God is empowering them. Moses is holding his arms up, just like Joshua's holding the javelin up in this last story. And he takes and forms a military and fights a battle. He's able to come into the land and conquer the land. And we're going to see many of Joshua's battles in the book of Joshua. Some have suggested that instead of just being a slave that was making bricks, that he may have been somehow in training, some kind of military training in the Egyptian forces, so that when he came out, he's got some experience. That's not unusual that the people that had experience, whatever they're trained in Egypt, they carried it on with them into the wilderness. For example, the metalworking, the metal craftsmanship, that's not something they just made up when they got up. They made the golden calf. They had skill in forming these idols. They had form in building. They had form or skills in these areas. And so it's possible to think that Joshua had some kind of training from the Egyptians in military. It's not explicit, but otherwise you've just got this guy just starting and leading military. And you'd think, you're just like David. David had experience at different levels working into this place. I'm thinking about it, and we got it in the notes for the new notes, but Joshua, it was originally, his name was Hoshea. Like we've got Hosea, the prophet. This is Hoshea. Hoshea means saved or salvation. Moses changes Hoshea's name from salvation to Yah is salvation, or Yahweh is salvation. So it goes from being Hoshea to Joshea, or Joshua. So that the name, it's on the notes that you can see there. So the name Joshua is Moses changing the name from salvation to Yahweh saves, or Yahweh is salvation. So again, Joshua, we've got him as some kind of skill level, and a slave that becomes a military leader. Now we see him, he's going to be doing reading, he's going to be writing, leading these people. Again, there's some natural skill there, but yet Moses changes his name to Yahweh is salvation, meaning God is still empowering, doing the work. But I don't know if we want to overstep it, just like God just magically came down and gave him all of this military ability, all these skills of leadership. Something's been building, and Moses has been training. He's side by side with Moses for 40 years. Now, in Judges chapter 24, verse 26, I'm starting in verse 25. On that day, Joshua made a covenant for the people, and there at Shechem, and I've got pictures I'll show you, that we were at Shechem, and we saw Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim standing right in the middle. You look up and see both mountains, and they're still of the remains of a temple there at Shechem. It's going to play into the book of Judges where it turns into Baal, one of the Baal temples. But it most likely is a religious site that Joshua is going to go to at this point in the book. He's actually going to go to this site that was a religious ceremony. He's going to use it for Yahweh worship. It's going to be perverted back into Baal worship later on. But that's where he's at here most likely. The pillars are still standing there. That may have been the very pillars or remains of the pillars that were there in Joshua's day. He drew up for them decrees and laws. And so Joshua's doing some writing here. And Joshua recorded these things in the book of the law of God. Then he took a large stone and set it up there under the oak near the holy place of the Lord. Now, the holy place of the Lord, that's not Jerusalem. This is Shechem. This would be where northern Israel is going to go. See, he said to the people, this stone will be a witness against us. It has heard all the words the Lord has said to us. It will be a witness against you if you are untrue to your God. And we'll go, when we get there, we'll talk about what's taking place on Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. But Joshua's doing reading, he's recording, he's putting things into written form, and part of it is the covenant. And the stone that he's setting up there, where this place is at, it's still visible. The remains of an ancient site is still there. The oak tree is gone. But there's that. Now, going back to the notes on page 1, point D, the author was a contemporary of the people and events in the books, having lived through this phase of history. Joshua chapter 4, verse 9, and chapter 7, verse 26, when Joshua was being written, the memorial stone still stood when this book was written. Now, we could go through each of these verses, but it's going to say, to this day. Well, let's go to at least one more. Chapter 4, verse 9. And again, I'd like to go through all of these. I should have just cut and pasted the text right in there. I was planning on reading them, but I can feel that's going to be kind of long. Chapter 4, verse 9. This is when they crossed the Jordan. It stopped flowing. They crossed the Jordan. And for a memorial, someone from each of the tribes, one of the men from each of the tribes, is to pick up a stone from the bottom of the Jordan. Where it's dried up, the waters, it's backed up to a place called Adam. You can see it on the maps. There's a city called Adam. However, it stopped flowing. There might have been a cave in, the dirt blocked the way, some kind of a natural dam formed for a while. But it stopped flowing all the way up, and they walked across. And so they're crossing the Jordan, and it's during the flood season when it's high. And so the men pick up a stone. Probably not a pebble, obviously. They're picking up a stone that they could not naturally grab and swim back to the surface with. And they take those 12 stones to the other side and they put them in a circle at a place called Gilgal, which means the place of the circle, as the memorial. They kept meeting at this place, at the place of the circle, because this was what they remembered. God parted the Jordan. He wants us here. Not only do they have the promise to Abraham, they have manifestation of God acting in their life and making this come to pass. And so nonetheless, it says, so the Israelites did, in verse 8 of chapter 4, did as Joshua commanded them. They took 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, according to the number of the tribes of Israelites, as the Lord had told Joshua. And they carried them over with them to their camp, where they put them down. Joshua set up the 12 stones that had been in the middle of the Jordan at the spot where the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant had stood. And they are there to this day. Now, whatever this day is, if it's the end as in Joshua's later years as he's putting these things, the final touches on the book, or if it's sometime being written by Samuel, which that's a suggestion. If it's something being written by one of the elders that was with Joshua that crossed the Jordan with him and wrote these things down. But they are saying to this day. So what you've got here to determine this day is you've got eyewitnesses. Whoever is writing this book saw these things take place. And later on in their life, they're recording these things saying it's been 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, and it's still there to this day. If you're going to have an eyewitness recording it, and then an editor coming back later, like sometime maybe Samuel or someone during the days of Judges saying, this is the eyewitness account, and it's still there today, you can say that. It just doesn't sound like something being written in Babylon, where they're saying to this day because they couldn't see it. They would be making up. They'd be writing something that was an old memory handed down, and they'd be using memorial to something that they maybe have never seen themselves, and they definitely can't look to see if it's there today because they're not in the land. So I'm really, it's easiest to say, tradition holds it this way, that this is being written by Joshua, who was there, who saw it, who wrote it down, and is saying, as he's finishing editing the book, you can still see it to this day, go check it out. And we continue on this, we'll see as we go through the book, Joshua 5:9. Contemporary names of places were still operative. In other words, there's things that were taking place, names that are going to change. As like sometimes you'll see like in Exodus where the word Ramses, they're building the storehouses at Ramses. If that's the case, you've got to push the book of Exodus 200 years ahead of 1406 when Ramses was being built, and then nothing makes sense. But Ramses was being built at storehouses could have been being built at a place where Ramses was later going to be built, and they could have updated the name so people would have known what they were talking about. In this book, there are names of places that were still operative, but by the time you get to David's day or you get to the Babylonian captivity, those places are no longer there. So that's one emphasis there, that these places were still functioning. They weren't memories of places. These were still there to see. Another one, Joshua chapter 6, verse 25. That's worth reading. Joshua chapter 6, verse 25. And this is when they had burned the chapter 6, verse 24, when they had burned the whole city, Jericho, and everything in it, but they put the silver and gold and the articles of bronze and iron into the treasury of the Lord's house. But Joshua spared Rahab the prostitute with her family and all who belonged to her. Again, that would be anyone who was in the household, not just family members, but if they had any kind of servants or anybody that was involved in the family. All who belonged to her, because she hid the men Joshua had sent as spies to Jericho. Now watch this part. And she lives among the Israelites to this day. Now there's a couple ways of reading that. Is she, Rahab, is still alive? Because it says that Rahab, it says, and she still lives when they divided. Because again, they came in 1406. And by 1401, 5 years, if you go 7 years for dividing the land up, it takes 7 years. Rahab is now living somewhere in the land of Israel in a portion of land, and she is still living there when this book is being written. So the indication is she still lives in this portion of land to this day. If it's 7 years later, if it's 10 years later, Rahab is still alive. But nonetheless, she moved into some kind of territory. Her family moved in to an allotment. If you want to say, well, Rahab, it doesn't mean Rahab herself, because this is written several years later. It means she would have passed away, but her family continued. Rahab, in the sense of Rahab's family, continues to live in this place. I go with this idea that Rahab was still alive when the book was being written, but it could mean Rahab, she's still alive living with her family, or her family's still living in this land whenever the book is being written. Again, doesn't make much sense for it to be written in the land of Babylon, to say Rahab or Rahab's family is still living. No one's living there to this day because you've all been driven out. So Rahab's long gone. Now Rahab is going to become, as you know, one of the descendants or the ancestors of King David. And then eventually she's going to be in the lineage of the Messiah. You knew this, right? That there's three women, especially three, Rahab, Ruth, and Bathsheba, are all in David's line. You've got a Canaanite from Jericho, you've got a Moabite in Ruth, and you've got a Jebusite with Bathsheba, all in the line of the Messiah. So that's kind of interesting when you think about that also. But nonetheless, you can see, because we're driving these people out, and they're following the Lord's command that's coming up here in the notes, and so the Canaanite's going to be destroyed. But it isn't, in a sense, a genocide of every last, some kind of a racial cleansing. It's more of a moral resetting. They're so corrupt, and these people need to be driven out of land. And when Israel becomes this way, God warns them, the same way the land is going to vomit these people out, the land of Israel will vomit out the Israelites themselves for their immorality. God told them that would happen. Moses did. Jeremiah, Isaiah talked about it, and it took place. So this is nothing about a genocide. It's about morals, which should be a warning to us as a nation, as an individual. We think we can live the way we want. Things are going fine because we're breaking reality. We're coming against truth. But it's like you do this long enough, truth is going to vomit you out. Reality is going to vomit you out. You cannot continue to live contrary to the way God established things, and everything's going to be fine. You can't create your own reality. The very fact people think they can, and they keep pushing the boundaries, is because, like Peter writes, God is gracious, wanting everyone to come to the place where He wants you to figure it out. He warns you, if it's by the Spirit, if it's by situations. But usually when you harden your heart, Paul talks, or the Bible talks about you being calloused, your heart being calloused. You can't sense it. You can't tell anymore. And you just continue to go into darkness, hard-hearted, calloused, and walk right into judgment, not knowing it's going to come. So if you're getting away with sin for a while, and you think, oh, this is never going to catch up, that's a good sign, maybe an indication that hardness has set in. And again, Rahab is going to come over. The Gibeonites are going to come up. They don't know what to do. They're going to use deception, but they're going to come over and make a treaty because they know they're going to get overrun by the people of Yahweh. So they manipulate the situation, trying to get in, and they then are welcomed in. There's a place where we'll talk about that. But anyone who's going to come against Israel and fight against Yahweh, they're going to be destroyed. I mean, one of the things, why do you think they're going to march around Jericho for 7 days? It's like, here's your warning. Anybody want to change your mind? Here's your second warning. And the thing is, they're not fighting back. They're just watching, wondering what's going to happen. Well, there's a good chance they had plenty of opportunity, especially as city after city was wiped out. But nonetheless, Rahab was welcomed with them, and she was still alive, living with her family there when this book was written. The destructive evidence of victory still exists. Again, this is interesting about this whole thing, is if we go with the 1406 destruction, we're going to see, and I've got pictures of it, and we'll talk about it. 1406, there's going to be Hazor, is going to be a key place. There's going to be some burned evidence. There's going to be some destruction. But as you read through the book of Joshua, it is not a full-scale annihilation of just like the Assyrians coming through like they did in Sennacherib's day, and just city after city is just burnt. Or it's very easy to see the Babylonian destruction, the burn line in Jerusalem today. When you hit there and you find a certain, like if it's a special building or a royal building, you can find that's where they just find handfuls of boule, you know, the clay seals that have been glazed, that all the scrolls are burned up. And because you can see the burn layers. You can see the burn layer at Hazor. In fact, the book of Joshua says, and Joshua burnt Hazor. And you can see this. We've seen the ash layer at Hazor. You're going to be able to see the destruction at Jericho, because very clearly it takes place there. And there's a few battles that we're going to talk about on the entrance campaign, the central campaign, the southern campaign, and then the northern campaign. But after that, remember the promise. You're going to go into a land and live in houses you didn't build, and harvest grapes from vineyards you didn't plant. In other words, it's not a whole-scale destruction of the land. They have a few battle sites, a few major cities are defeated. Hazor was the major city to the north. Jericho was the fortress on the east side as you came into the land. There are some places that they took out, but it wasn't a whole-scale destruction. So you can find some of the evidence, but one of the things that throws people off when they get into the archaeology is you get up around 1200, where you want to have the Ramses, you know, being the Pharaoh of the Exodus, and then you're going to have the entrance. There is a lot of destruction at this time in Israel, and there's cities that are burnt to the ground. And they say, look, that must be Joshua, because these are cities that have been burnt, destroyed right around this time, and they're trying to make that the evidence. The problem with that is, again, if you want to go with that, go for it. But that is nothing more than the period of the judges, when Israel's in rebellion and Israel's cities are getting destroyed by Egypt. Egypt is moving through the land, and Midianites are moving through the land. And you've got all the stories of judges and destruction. So these destructive layers are not the destructive layers of this. In fact, you should see some at some very specific points in 1406 to 1405. But if you see a whole-scale destruction of the land, it doesn't match the biblical account. So keep that in mind. You can find things that we need to, but you shouldn't find everything. Joshua 9:27, the Gibeonites were still serving Israel. They made a treaty with them, and when this book was being written, the Gibeonites were still working and serving the Israelites. Joshua 10:27, the hiding places where the kings went were still known. Certain people were still living with Israel, 13:13, 15:63. The Jebusites still inhabited Jerusalem. For example, Jerusalem was never taken on the entrance campaign. Jerusalem was a fortress, and they could take land around it, but they could never take the city of Jerusalem. Not until who? Who takes Jerusalem? David is the first one. David, it's going to be, get this, it's going to be 1,000, let's say 1,005, 1,005 before David takes Jerusalem. Again, if you say he became king in 1,005, and then you're going to have 7 years in Hebron, it might be 996, 998. But David is going to be the first one. So you're 400 years away from Jerusalem. It's not going to be taken for 400 years because it is such a strong Jebusite stronghold. There's a Jebusite stronghold in Joshua's day. It was still a Jebusite city in David's day. In fact, David buys the northern Temple Mount just north of the city of Jabesh, or Salem in Abraham's day. He buys it from, what is his name, Arnuk the Jebusite. It's a threshing floor of a farmer outside the city of Jerusalem, a Jebusite, and David buys it from him. So when they take the city, the Jebusites still continue living, and David didn't kill him. He paid him for it after he took the city of the Jebusites. And so nonetheless, the Jebusites were still in Jerusalem in chapter 15. Joshua 16:10, certain Canaanites were still living and serving Israel. Joshua 23:9, the writer documented Joshua's final speech. Joshua 13:4 and 19:29, Tyre had not yet been conquered by Sidon. Tyre had conquered Sidon in the 1100s BC. So we're 300 years away from Tyre conquering Sidon, and Sidon is still sitting up there by itself, not being conquered by Tyre. So again, that indicates a historical event. The points have got written down here. The place for the book of Joshua, it falls in this sequence, Genesis through Deuteronomy. Again, making it very simple. Genesis through Deuteronomy record the time leading up to the land. It's the promise. The promise to Abraham, the forming of the nation through his son and his grandsons and his great-grandsons, and them going into Egypt and coming out of the Exodus. It's about now here we've got a nation. They go in with 70 people, and they come out with thousands of people ready to become a nation. Took four generations, took 400 years, and God tells Abraham, I'm going to wait 400 years. We've got to go to Genesis 15 tonight. We're going to wait 400 years because the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached fulfillment. Now again, 400 years. After they go into captivity, it's going to be 400. They're going to spend four generations or 400 years in a land, a foreign land, and then they're going to come and take the land from the Canaanites, from the Amorites. And God tells Abraham, because the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached fulfillment. It's not final. They're starting to go astray. Remember, there's still followers of Yahweh in the land of Canaan when Abraham's there, mainly Melchizedek. They're going to go into captivity, and then they're going to come back. So Canaan is going to be drifting off and getting more and more in decline during this time, and Israel's waiting for the timing to be right. Then Joshua records God blessing and giving them the land, the blessing and fulfillment. Judges through 2 Chronicles records Israel living in the land and generally being disobedient and then ultimately losing the blessing. And then the prophets Isaiah through Malachi record the judgment of Israel because they disobeyed, like the Canaanites did, but a promise of restoration. The Canaanites had the land, but they were removed because they did not have a covenant. Israel had a covenant and were brought into the land, but when they became disobedient, they were removed. But along with that covenant, upon removal, was also a promise of restoration because they have a covenant. Thus, the simple meaning, Jacob I have loved, Esau I have hated. Jacob's got a covenant, and when they get sent away, they're going to be disciplined, but eventually brought back to fulfill the Abrahamic covenant. When the Canaanites disobey, they'll be eliminated from history. When Esau disobeys, they'll be eliminated from history. When the Americans disobey, they'll be eliminated from history, and another people will occupy the land. But Israel is loved. They have the Abrahamic covenant. We may be a godly nation. We may be built on Christian principles, but America does not have the Abrahamic covenant. We are a Gentile pagan nation following God or not following God. When God is finished with us, we'll be moved out of history, never to be heard from again. Israel has an Abrahamic covenant. They'll be disciplined and put somewhere, but they will always be brought back. That is the difference between Israel and every other nation in the history of the world. They are God's nation. And again, Joshua is them coming into the land. And again, you can say it's their land, but it's not going to be their land restored until God brings them back. Now, God's the one who sent them out with the Babylonian captivity, brought them back at the right time, after 70 years, just like Jeremiah said. Then they were taken out by the Romans, and they're still going to be brought back. When they'll be brought back, maybe it's begun, maybe there's a sign in 1948 in Israel in the land now, that may be a sign that we're getting close, but we can't do it ourselves. The world can't create this, Israel can't create it. It's going to have to be God bringing them back, and He will, and there'll be no doubt about it when these events start to take place. The outline of the book, chapters 1 through 5, again, we're going to get to these chapters eventually, is invading the land. We're going to go across. They're going to be on the other side of the Jordan. They're going to cross the land, go to Gilgal. They're going to celebrate the Passover, and then they're going to take Jericho, and then they're going to be in the land. Then they're going to have the central campaign where they're going to take Ai and some of the central land, and then they're going to have the southern campaign in chapter 10 where they're going to go south all the way down to the Negev or the Negev. And then they're going to turn and go north up to Hazor from the Megiddo Valley, meet the Canaanite forces in the Megiddo Valley, Jezreel Valley, and go up to Hazor, and there they're going to burn the city of Hazor. And that's been being excavated for, oh, I don't know how many years. Amon Ben Tours there now, and he replaced one of the legendary archaeologists. So it's been 30 years they've been excavating Hazor at least. The northern campaign, and you can see the burning of Hazor. And then Joshua chapter, I hope you're having fun now. I hope you enjoy the battles, because look in chapter 13 through 21, the division of the land. You've got 13 through 21 of maps, except there's no maps. I got to create the maps. There's just place names. From this rock to that tree to this brook to that town to this is going to be the territory. And you go all the way around for the land of Zebulun, and then the land of Issachar, and then you start naming locations. It's like it's one of those, if you want, you know, you talk about the genealogies being boring, read about the land formations from this ravine up to this hill to the base of this mountain. That will be the land of, and you do that for all those chapters. We'll do it, but I'll give you a map, but we'll do it. And then Joshua 22 through 24, living in the land. And that's where Joshua's, they're going to be living. They're all going to settle down. Joshua's going to say, okay, I got you in the land. God has you in the land. My advice to you is obey God. He got you here. Notice what He did to the people that weren't obeying Him. He'll do the same thing to you. I've got a few things written down here on why destroy the Canaanites. But I think we've got, I got more details coming up in another set of notes. But why destroy the Canaanites? Canaanites were not innocent people. According to Leviticus 18:22, they were totally depraved. And we can read about that here in a little bit. The Canaanites knew of and had a chance to respond to the God of Israel. Rahab herself even says, we saw what Yahweh did to Egypt. We know what you're going to do to us. I will help you. So she knew. And everybody, and she wasn't like one of the leaders. She knew. You can't do to Egypt. You understand this. Egypt was a powerful nation. Egypt was the center of the civilization at that point. And when Egypt goes through a year of plagues and the Pharaoh is brought to his knees and all the plagues and all the death, and trade was interrupted. Everyone, especially the land of Canaan, heard about what was happening in Egypt, and that this Moses and his God Yahweh and the slaves were just walking out. They heard about it in Jericho. They heard about it all around. It was not a surprise. So when Joshua comes over and the spies are there at Rahab's, she says, "We knew. We've been waiting for you." In fact, if you go back to the text, Moses sent Joshua and Caleb and 10 other guys in as spies 38 years, you could say 40, but they'd already been in the wilderness for a couple years, 38 years before the spies got to Rahab's house. So she was probably born and grew up hearing stories about what happened in Egypt and how these people were just in the wilderness. In other words, if the spies had obeyed, Jericho would have been destroyed and the Canaanites would have been destroyed 40 years before that. So they got a bonus 40 years because Israel wasn't being responsive. Point C, God is not just a merciful God, but He is also a God of judgment and war. Once again, we go back to our apologetic argument. If you're going to have a God of love and a God of mercy and a God of fairness, then that fairness is going to require that just like He gives love and mercy, He's going to bring judgment and vengeance on those who reject the love and mercy. So if you're going to have a God of love and mercy, that same God is going to be a God of war. It's like, I mean, I don't think the average American can handle that concept. We just want a God of love. Well, understand, Jesus is that God of love, that God of mercy. You're saved by grace. But do you understand what Jesus did to get you that grace? He didn't just come and say, "You're forgiven, you're forgiven, you're forgiven." He went to the cross and paid the price, the vengeance for the sin of mankind, so you could receive the grace. And so it wasn't just all whimsical. He had to face the penalty and pay the price. So again, that God is going to come and judge people for their wickedness, as surely as God is merciful to those who reach out and cry out for mercy, He is going to be judgmental and destructive to those who are not. Now, with that being said, let's see. While we're looking at this, I do have on this page, on the second page of notes, while we're here, while we're talking about, go to, oh boy, 1, 2, 3, 4. It's the third page of paper. It's the fifth page of notes. And here's some more details before we look at the maps. Yeah, I'm not going to get through all of this. Point two on that fifth page or the third page of notes, it's got the map at the top is Numbers 34. We'll come back and look at that on the other set of notes. I've got a bigger map for you. I've got there point two is these notes were in development and I got sidetracked making maps. You see right here the size of the land, the promised borders, the borders at the end of Joshua, the borders in David's kingdom, the borders at the kingdom of the Messiah. I'm going to be able to show you A and B tonight, but I do not have the borders of David's kingdom. It's in your Bibles if you want to go to the back of the book and look at it. And then the borders of the kingdom of the Messiah, we can also go find those. But Joshua, here it is, the name, Joshua, originally was Hoshea, which means salvation in Hebrew. I mentioned that. Moses changed it to Joshua in Numbers 13:16 when it says the names of 12 spies that went up. Hoshea was one of them, but then it has parentheses. Moses changed his name to Joshua. His name was Salvation. Moses changed it to Yahweh is Salvation. And you can see it right there. You can see Joshua being spelled in transliteration in Hebrew means Yahweh is Salvation, where Hoshea, I got it all written out right there. So Yah plus Hoshea means Yahweh Salvation. Interesting point four, Joshua in Hebrew is spelled that way, pronounced Yeshua or Joshua, which corresponds, if you translate it, transliterated into Greek, it's spelled Jesus, which then through Latin it becomes Jesus, which in English it becomes Jesus. So when you go from Hebrew to Greek to Latin to English, Jesus is the word, the name Joshua. When the angel says, name him Jesus, she's saying in Greek, Jesus, or Latin, Mary's being told to name him Jesus or Yeshua. And so Joshua and Jesus have the same name. They're just 1,400 years apart, and different languages. But nonetheless, they're the same name. Jesus' name means Yahweh is salvation. Point B, he was a slave in Egypt. We talked about that and mentioned the military training. I'll turn the page, he's a military leader in the wilderness versus the Amalekites. We'll talk about that. We should talk about that sometime. Servant of Moses at Mount Sinai. He was a spy in Canaan. Moses' replacement is a general and national leader. Oh, this is interesting, if you don't mind. Point I, or letter I. If Joshua was 35 at the time of Exodus, Caleb was clearly 40 years old, according to Joshua 14:10. You can say Joshua's 40 if you want to. Then Joshua would have been 75 in 1406. When this is taking place, Josh would be 75, or if you want to say he's 80. But we know he's going to die at 110. So he's going to die in 1371. If he's 35 in 1446, 75 in 1406 when he leads them across the Jordan after being with Moses for 40 years, that means he's going to die at the age of 110, which would be 1371. Remember, these battles got over with about 1401. And then they're going to spend a couple years dividing the land up, finishing the book, Joshua saying goodbye. So now you're down to 1399. If he lives to be 110, which he does, the Bible says he lives to be 110, it's going to be the year 1371 before Joshua is dead. So you've got some time between 1406 and 1371 for Joshua to write these books and for him to say, and those stones are still there today, Rahab still lives among us today, he could be writing that in 1375. So that's your time frame right there, depending on how old he is when he comes out of slavery with Moses. The Canaanites, I wanted to show you this. The Canaanites, they're evil people according to the Lord because Deuteronomy 20 verse 18, they worship false gods. Now when we talk about false gods, that's going to be a false reality. They've got false views of nature. They've got false views of fertility. They've got false views of morals. They've got false views of the way society functions. They've got false, they're influenced by demonic ideas. They're not in tune with reality. And a little bit is destructive, but a little bit leads to more. More confusion leads to complete chaos, and complete chaos leads to just a broken down society where you're going to end up with some of the crazy things you see the Canaanites doing. Deuteronomy 12:31 says they sacrificed their children to their gods. They wanted to please their gods, make their gods move on their behalf, and the best way to make a god see you, honor you, is to give him one of your children. What could be more precious than not just a financial donation, but how about we sacrifice a child to this god? Will that make the god move? And that's what they were doing. That's, I mean, my friends, I mean, for me, and you decide, and again, I'm looking for connections, but when you start talking about false science and how to control the environment and the climate, and you start talking about we need to kill babies and have abortions, do you understand in my mind, again, you can judge me, say I'm extreme, but they were trying to manipulate their culture, their environment, their climate, because they thought the gods controlled it. They had false views of the actual, the seasons and what caused them and what caused the weather. And they thought they could somehow influence and save themselves from the climate if they killed their children. I mean, you can just see, you can just see, we've got people that want to scream, we got to save the planet, and how are we going to do it? Well, we're going to somehow connect killing babies in this whole thing, and it's all, I mean, you understand, we're so close to crossing the line, and the only thing that's probably saving us is the fact that we're coming out of the modern age, where everything is scientific. But if we cross over into the postmodern age, where things become emotional, things become spiritual, how you feel, you're going to be in a demonic activity, and you're going to make some direct connections. And now you're going to have this. Listen, these gods that they were worshiping, they are still in existence. These gods, and some of the things that are taking place in our culture, that are taking place around the world, mankind is depraved. mankind can go to a certain level of depravity. But there is a place where demonic activity kicks in and takes it to like hyper depravity, where demonism is actually functioning through human decisions, human activity, and that's when God comes in and eliminates the society. So when we talk about the Canaanites, there was not just human depravity, there was demonic manifestations taking place. Well, going on. Deuteronomy 18, 9 through 11, they practiced magic. In Abraham's day, the sin and society depravity had begun. Sodom, for example, in Genesis 19 was a Canaanite city. The Canaanites, or also known as Amorites, still had time to repent and restore their minds and their culture to reality before a total natural disaster would take place in 400 years or four generations after they went to Israel and went into Egypt. In Genesis 15, 13, that's going to be a huge verse. I have to pick up that with that next week. I didn't get to use my maps tonight. But this right here, this first map page, Genesis 15, 17 through 21, I'll try to remember to begin there next week, because that is where God cuts the Abrahamic covenant. He makes a promise to him when he's in the land of Ur. He comes across and gives him several promises and talks to him, but he actually in Genesis 15 comes and makes a covenant in Genesis 15. And in that covenant, he says, "Then the Lord, Yahweh, said to Abraham, 'Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. That's Joseph, or the generation after Joseph, until Moses. You can count it. It's there. That if you get 1406 for the Exodus, you can figure out when Joseph was in the land, and you can figure out what Pharaoh he was serving. I mean, it's there. They've got records. It fits. You can almost see the time when Abraham went down and spoke with one of their leaders. But nonetheless, in Genesis 15, 16, "And they shall come back here," God tells Abraham, his descendants, "in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites," which is another name for the Canaanites, "is not yet complete." There's still time. They haven't reached total depravity where there's no hope for them. They haven't completely became demonic. Melchizedek was a priest of God at that time, Most High. He was a priest of God Most High living in Salem. And that was the right God. So understand, Abraham was not an evangelist. Some would want to say he was, and of course he was sharing his God with people. But when he gets to the land of Canaan, there was already in Salem, in the city of the Jebusites, a king named Melchizedek. Now, are you ready? Melchizedek, the king that Joshua is going to kill from Jerusalem. They're not going to take Jerusalem, but they're going to kill the king from Jerusalem because he comes out and joins in battle. His name is Adonai Zedek. Melchizedek was the king. Melchizedek was the king in Abraham's day. You go 600 years later, the king's name was Adonai Zedek. So in other words, it's very similar. Very similar. Point three, God is just and will punish the sin. I mentioned that. Oh, the Rosh Shamra tablets. I've actually ordered a couple books about these. I've got to talk more about this later. But listen to this. Oh, boy. There is living... What time is it? Yeah, here is Dead Sea, Galilee, Jordan River, land of Israel. Josh is going to cross right here. He's going to go down south. Going to come up to Hazor right here. This is Syria. There is a culture up here and a language that is very similar. Ugaritic. Ugaritic, and you can see that at the bottom of that page right there. It's the Ugaritic language, and there it's called the Rosh Shama tablets, written in cuneiform, which was the language of the writing of the time. Now remember, Joshua's writing. And remember, in the 1800s, the scholars were telling us Moses couldn't write. Joshua's illiterate. None of these things, they couldn't write any of these things down. Because it just tells you, Joshua's reading the law. He's writing into the law. He's recording. It says he's writing in the book of Joshua. And they said, no, that's not true. That's not true. That can't happen in the 1800s. They taught that in seminaries. In 1928, you can see this on the page right here, 1928, this is just one of them, beginning in 1928, going up until 1994, they began uncovering the Ugaritic text from Syria. There's a location up here where they found an archive, and there are these tablets, and they've got stories and records and practices and their religion and the Baals and all the details describing the people of this land right here. Because again, Syria, Lebanon, Phoenicia, if I was going to get to the map, this is all the land. This is Paul, the promised land. And this is Egypt is here. Now we're talking 160 miles from here to here. Okay? So you go from up here, you go like 400 miles across here. I mean, that's not that much space. This is all the same culture. In fact, the language is very similar. But in these, they were discovered, and they begin to describe, if you look on the next page, they are written at the height of their power from 1450 B.C. until they were destroyed in the 1200s. So these tablets go from 1450 to the 1200s. Do you see the significance of that dating? These tablets were written records of the very people that Joshua was fighting against and that was there during the days of the judges. And then a sea people came over sometime during the time of the judges or right before the time of the judges, right after Joshua. The sea people came to fight. They came from Crete. They came from they're Grecians. They came from, this is throughout, it's in the Bible. It's in history. They came and fought Egypt. Egypt has got murals inscribed of the battles of them fighting the sea people. The sea people tried to take Egypt. There's some kind of climate change that is taking place here. There's climate change, and it changed the weather patterns. If it was volcanic, something happened. It happened in the Middle Ages also. Things changed. The weather changed. Farmland changed. And these people had to migrate to a new place for some reason, the sea people. And they didn't take Egypt, but they settled on the plain right here. They become the Philistines. They're known as the sea people. They overran into these entire communities. They over by 1200, the sea people just kept coming. The Greeks just kept coming. That it's recorded in the Bible. That's why the Philistines were Greek. They're even doing DNA tests now. They are Greeks. They are Europeans. You can Google it. They're doing DNA tests on the bones in Philistia. And they came from Europe. But when they came to fight David, what is unique, and I've got to quit, when they came to fight David, a very unique thing takes place. They march out and say, hey, why don't you send your champion out and we'll send our champion out. It sounds like a Bible story, and it is in the Bible. But it's not just a Bible story. It's Grecian warfare of the 1200s. It's how they fought in Europe at that time. Instead of your nation fighting my nation, your city fighting my city, let's just have a champion. Well, let's play fair. Your champion versus our champion. And if your champion wins, then we'll serve you. If our champion wins, well, then you'll serve us. We all don't have to die. Ready? Go get him, Goliath. And Saul was supposed to be the champion. And Saul's like, that's not how we fight warfare here. But they're fighting Greek style. It's the original Grecian warfare. And they came down and they were fighting Greek style. And David said, I'll do it. I'll use the name of the Lord and fight this battle because he's the mighty warrior. And he came up, takes out Goliath. And the Philistines go, we didn't think that was going to happen. They all started running. We changed our minds. But they were planning on winning because they had. And again, that was the result of the sea people. The saint recorded the sea people penetrated into the land, the coast, and then penetrated in, bringing their pottery, their Greek pottery, their Greek culture into Syria and wiped these people out. Nonetheless, these Rosh Shema tablets are the recordings of this culture at this time. Now, again, we got to talk more about that too, what's taking place right here. It's amazing. I mean, it's amazing. You do not have a fictional Bible And do not let someone tell you all this was written in the days of the Babylonians. I've read the critics, and they say, and the stupidest, lowest level you can go to, is that the people of the Jews in Babylonian captivity had to, you know, get themselves fired back up, and so they created a whole history. They created the ideal of Abraham. They're called minimalists, meaning a very, very minimal part of the Bible is true. Yeah, the Babylonian captivity was true, and the people came over, and they came back, and they had to tell themselves some stories about how great they were and rebuild their kingdom. But, I mean, who begins with, I mean, look how lame of a story it is. Abraham was an Amorite. It even says it in the book. Your father, Joshua will say, your father, Abraham, was an Amorite. And he came out, he was the Ur of the Chaldeans. He was a Gentile. And he came out and the promise, I'll give you this land, but you can't have it. You're going to have a family, they're going to go down, they're going to be slaves. Then after 400 years, I'm going to bring them out, and I'm going to bring you into the land of Canaan. Then when they do come to the land of Canaan, they have a great five-year run. Then they all become disobedient and have the days of the judges. I mean, at what point is your story going to start to be positive? Abraham lies. Abraham's son is deceived, and his grandsons are deceitful. His great-grandsons send one of the great-grandsons into slavery, and now they're slaves for 400 years. It's like then they come back, they conquer the land, and then they are all overrun by the Midianites and the Moabites and the Ammonites, and they don't obey, and now the judgment starts. And finally, David rises up. They have a brief moment where David builds an empire. Then Solomon disobeys, starts worshiping Molech, and then they split, and then they end up in dispersion and captivity. Listen, if you're going to make a story, I do in my genealogy, and I can trace my genealogy back to Charlemagne. Right. But I Googled some information, you know, so, you know, Charlemagne answered, and it says, if you're from Europe, Charlemagne's in your ancestry. I got 2 points going. My point is, if you're going to create a lineage, you can do better than the Jews did. It's got to be real. If you're going to fake a story, fake something better than this. I said just a bunch of disobedient people that end up in captivity. Anyway, like I said last week, if you trace back 32 generations, you have 8 billion 28 great-grandparents. Which means when you get back there, you have more great-grandparents mathematically than you have people on the earth. Which means your genealogy at some point has to start. You just can't keep branching out because you're not going to go back. Let's just say you go back to Noah. You're not just going to keep branching out and there's going to be, you know, 14 trillion Noahs. There's only one Noah. So you go from one or two and start building up. And at some point, it's got to level off and start mixing together. And maybe you can separate your genealogy. Say, well, I'm not remarried. I didn't marry my cousin. I didn't marry my second cousin. But eventually, when you get to the Middle Ages, you get back to 1600s, 1400s, 900. There's not enough people on earth at that time for your 8 billion grandparents to all be alive. In other words, if you're from Europe, Charlemagne's probably in your, we're probably related. Anyway, that's not the point, but that's where we ended. Thank you for coming. I'll pray and you're free to go. Father, we thank you again for the chance to look into these things. We thank you for your truth. We ask that we again may honor your word, that we may understand it and make correct application to our own lives, that we may serve you and look forward to your promise of the things that you promised Abraham took place in Joshua's life, just as surely as the things you promised in Scripture for us will take place in our lives. Father, we do again ask that we'd walk confidently and witness about you, testify to your truth, both in our words and our lifestyle. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your patience.